Chapter 11. Nadezhda Yakovlevna, Tuesday, the 21st of May, 1934. It was my dear friend Anna Andreevna who kept her wits until mine trickled back. When we spoke of my husband's arrest years later, Akhmatova claimed I had sobbed until the tear ducts ran dry, at which point I began seething against everything and everybody under the sun. Mandelstam, for truth-telling in the swamp of lies. The Kremlin mountaineer, for equating the rant of a poet with a counter-revolutionary act. The moths who bred in the felt insulation in our walls. The neighbour Sergei Petrovich, who had betrayed the teapot to the Cheka. Myself, for not having had the courage to talk my husband into a joint suicide pact when I realized he was determined to propagate his epigram. Yes, yes, I see now that we should have killed ourselves the instant we heard that late-night knock on the door. It was only after I'd gotten hold of myself that Anna and I began to think constructively. A day after Mandelstam's arrest, we packed socks and underwear and soap and cigarettes and 200 grams of smoked ham into a small carton and made the rounds of Moscow's prisons to see which one might accept the package for the prisoner Mandelstam. At Anna's suggestion, we started with Butyrki, where writers and artists were usually taken for questioning. Ahead of us in line were two little girls, perhaps 5 and 7, wearing starched dresses and telling everyone within earshot, "Mother has been arrested." Eventually a soldier turned up from a side door and led the girls away. Behind us, one woman told another, "We must send our children to their grandparents before this happens to them." After 2.5 hours of queuing, Akhmatova and I finally reached the window, only to be turned away by a baby-faced guard, who went down his list and announced there was nobody by the name of Mandelstam there. The Lubyanka came next. We waited for almost 2 hours in a light rain, the two of us huddled under a broken umbrella, before we reached the window. And lo and behold, the guard on duty checked the name on the damp package against a typewritten list, and, without a word, accepted it. "At least we know where he is," I said, relishing this small triumph. "We also know he is alive, or was when they typed up this list," Anna said. "I didn't want to frighten you when we were turned away from Butyrki, but if a prisoner is dead, that's another reason they won't accept the package." Looking back now, I remember that we were both quite astonished that we hadn't been arrested as co-conspirators, if only because our arrest would have given them more leverage with Mandelstam. I desperately tried to get in touch with Zinaida to make sure she had destroyed the only copy of the Stalin epigram in my husband's handwriting. But whoever answered the telephone in her communal apartment off the Arbat said she was seldom to be found there these days. After I don't remember how many phone calls, I managed to get her agronomist husband on the line. Of course, I couldn't come right out and ask him if she had destroyed the poem, but I did elicit the information that she was rehearsing a new play and had most certainly not been picked up by the police. "You catch me at a bad moment," he said. "We are divorcing, and I am in the process of moving out. As for Zinaida, she has always steered clear of anything that smacked of politics, so the idea that she might be detained by the Cheka is absurd. In point of fact, they are going to accord her a Moscow residence permit. If I were you, the last thing I would do is lose sleep over her." I will concede I was terribly relieved to hear that Zinaida had not been arrested. I would not have been able to look myself in the eye if our friendship had landed her in trouble with the authorities. While I was trying, without success as it turned out, to track down Zinaida, Anna got in touch with Boris Pasternak and informed him of my husband's arrest. He was overwhelmed with remorse at not having been able to talk Mandelstam into destroying the offending epigram. "I never find the right words when I need them," he reproached himself. He promised to immediately contact Nikolai Bukharin to see if he could do anything. He urged me to do the same. The more of us who talk to him, the more likely it is that he will consent to stick his neck out for Osip. I absolutely must have a word with Nikolai Ivanovich, I told Bukharin's secretary, a thin woman named Karatkova, whom my husband had described, in his fourth prose, as a squirrel who chews a nut with every visitor. You look pale as death, she said. Has something happened? I could only catch my breath and nod. Mandelstam has been imprisoned in the Lubyanka, I said. Karatkova had a good heart. She took my hand and squeezed it. Nikolai Ivanovich has a full schedule this morning, but I will somehow work you in. And she did, between two editors who emerged from his office jotting notes on a pad, and a woman waiting to wheel in a trolley with the linotype slugs of his Vestia's front page locked into a wooden frame. When he caught sight of me, Nikolai Ivanovich drew me over to the couch.
Pasternak has already been to see me, he said in a muffled voice.
Did he fear that microphones had been planted in his walls?
What has that husband of yours done now? Mandelstam hasn't written something outrageous, has he?
Bukharin was a slight man with a ruddy goatee that in happier times lent him a raffish air. These days he had the preoccupied appearance of someone with a terminal illness. He'd been expelled from the Politburo in the late 20s, but his absence from the inner circle had apparently not poisoned his relationship with Stalin, who appointed him editor of his Vestia and let him keep his Kremlin apartment despite the occasional friction between them. Still, rumours had been circulating in Moscow that Bukharin's days were numbered, that if Zinoviev and Kamenev were brought to trial, which many thought of as a probability as opposed to a possibility, to save their skins they would implicate Nikolai Ivanovich, and that would be the end of him. I felt terrible bringing my troubles to someone who had so many of his own, but what was I to do? He still had the ear of Stalin. If only he would consent to put a word in. Nothing more outrageous than the poems you know, I told Bukharin, stretching the truth for fear he wouldn't dare lift a finger for Mandelstam if he knew what was in the epigram. I come to you, Nikolai Ivanovich, as my last and best hope. And I went on to describe the life Mandelstam had been reduced to living, borrowing money to make ends meet, reading his poems aloud in return for cigarettes, making the rounds of editors, who, when he managed to get past the secretaries, invented one excuse or another for not publishing his work. I spoke of the heart palpitation that had rendered Mandelstam's health fragile. I even described how he had fabricated a copy of Stone to sell to an editor who was buying up original manuscripts for the new literary fund library. You helped Dossier's brother in the early 20s, I pleaded. You must absolutely help Osya now. Bukharin listened so intently the cigarette in his mouth burnt down and singed his lips, and he had to spit it out and grind the end under his heel on the floor.
Times have changed, he said. These days I am not confident I can help myself.
I had steeled myself to come away empty-handed, but tears welled in my eyes. He produced a handkerchief and awkwardly offered it to me.
Control yourself, I beg you, Nadezhda Yakovlevna, he said,
and pacing back and forth in his enormous office, he bombarded me with questions.
Have you attempted to see him? He demanded.
I explained that, thanks to Akhmatova, we had discovered he was being held in the Lubyanka, but visits to relatives in prison were out of the realm of possibility. They hadn't been allowed for years. I could tell from the expression on Bukharin's face that this came as news to him.
What article are they holding him under?
The usual one for political prisoners, Article 58, I said.
Bukharin paled. Anti-Soviet propaganda, counter-revolutionary activities, that's a bad omen. If only it had been a lesser charge.
He let the thought trail off, then came back at me with another question.
What was the rank of the senior checkist who arrested Orsip?
What difference does that make?
The higher the rank of the arresting officer, the more serious the case, the worse the fate of the prisoner.
He claimed to be a colonel, I said.
Bukharin shook his head in despair. The fact that they sent a full colonel is not a good sign. Most Article 58 prisoners are arrested by captains, majors at the most.
The telephone on his desk rang. Striding over, he brought it to his ear. Turning his back on me, lowering his voice, he spoke urgently into the mouthpiece. I thought I heard him pronounce Mandelstam's name.
"Don't hold up supper. I will be home late," he said,
and he hung down the phone.
"That was my wife," he told me. "Anna Larina is shaken by the news of Mandelstam's arrest, but she begged me not to get involved. Someone as well known as Osip Emilievich could only have been arrested with the knowledge of Stalin. It is quite likely that he was arrested on the instructions of Stalin. There is enough contentiousness between us without adding Mandelstam to the list of things Stalin holds against me, so my wife advised."
I rose to my feet and handed the handkerchief back to him. "She's right, of course," I said. "It was thoughtless of me to put you in this situation." Bukharin threw an arm over my shoulder and accompanied me to the door.
"We live in..."
He racked his brain for the appropriate word.
"We live in grim times. Korba," he went on, referring to Stalin by his Bolshevik nom de guerre, "is not the man he was when Lenin was alive. He sees himself surrounded by potential enemies. He suffers from pathological suspiciousness. He trusts no one. He schemes to turn one against the other, to divide and liquidate. He sided with Kamenev and Zinoviev against Trotsky, then with me against Kamenev and Zinoviev. When I was no longer useful to him, he threw me out of the Politburo and the Central Committee. I tell you, it will be a miracle if any of the old Bolsheviks survive."
"Thank you for seeing me, Nikolai Ivanovich."
"You were right to come," he said quickly. "One must do what one can to starve the beast. I will raise the subject of Mandelstam's arrest with Korba."
I had all to do not to burst into tears again. "Words fail me," I murmured. He managed a pained smile.
"Let us both hope they don't fail me."
Chapter 12. Nikolai Vlasic. Wednesday, the 22nd of May, 1934. There was no love lost between me and the so-called darling of the party, Nikolai Bukharin. On my all-time shit list, he was right up there with that Pigalle doorman, Maxim Gorky. Bukharin's squeamish take on the usefulness of Red Terror, his foot dragging on collectivization, his patronizing attitude toward the Khozayin, his intellectual arrogance all rubbed me the wrong way. Even Lenin, in his famous testament, felt obliged to concede that Bukharin was weak on dialectics. I don't have the foggiest idea why my boss put up with this smug son of a bitch. Maybe it was, as Yagoda once suggested, an attraction of opposites. Stalin was everything Bukharin wasn't, which is to say, someone who had the balls to follow his instincts where they led, as opposed to the spineless coffeehouse Marxist, who didn't want to soil his manicured fingernails constructing socialism. In the end, I suppose, the unlikely friendship, if friendship it was, could be chalked up to the Khozayin's lingering admiration for book learning, an acquired taste that dates back to his brief stint at a seminary when he was young. To this day, Joseph Vissarionovich keeps a stack of books on his desk and another on his night table, and I'm here to tell you they aren't there for decoration. Many's the time the boss, plagued by insomnia, would curl up in a reading chair, his nose glued to a book on the Napoleonic Wars or ancient Greece or the Persian Shahs or the Last of the Mohicans, which is how I'd find him when I came by with newspapers in the morning. I mention all this to explain why, when Bukharin showed up in the anteroom outside Comrade Stalin's hideaway office, without phoning ahead to ask for an appointment, mind you. I was predisposed to give him a hard time. "Raise your arms," I instructed him. "Raise my arms? Which words don't you understand? Raise? Your? Arms? Why would I want to raise my arms? Nobody gets in to see Comrade Stalin unless I pat them down for weapons." "You're not serious, Vlasic. Since when am I suspected of wanting to assassinate Stalin?" "I was born serious and become more so as I grow older. Either raise your arms or get out." Mortified, Bukharin slowly lifted his arms over his head, and I just as slowly frisked him, starting at the armpits and working my way down his trousers to the ankles, then back up the inside of his legs to the crotch. I spared him nothing. When I'd finished, he barged through the door into the Kozain's office. I followed him inside and took up a watchful position with my back against the door, my arms folded across my chest. "Koba, I must strongly protest against this indignity," Bukharin burst out. Comrade Stalin, sitting behind his desk, pushed aside the pile of state papers wrapped in newspaper. "What indignity are you talking about?" "Your bodyguard insisted on searching me like a common criminal before he would let me into your office," he sputtered. I'd been around the Kozain long enough to see he had all to do to keep from smiling. "Compose yourself, Bukharchik," he said, the tips of his mustache dancing on his cheeks, his eyes glinting with mirth. "It has nothing to do with you personally. Yagoda has decided that nobody can be permitted into my presence without first being searched for firearms. I was against the measure, but Yagoda insists it is a necessary precaution, given the current situation." "What situation?" Bukharin demanded. "Comrades thought to be close to me are known to be openly echoing Trotsky's critique of collectivization, which must be seen as an attack on Stalin's leadership." "Since when has it become a crime to criticize one policy or another?" Bukharin, uninvited, sank into the upholstered chair under the arched reading lamp. A photograph of Comrade Stalin in the very same chair, a book open on his lap, a pipe in one of his fists, had been published several months earlier in a popular weekly magazine. I know this detail because one of my concubines had cut it out and taped it to her vanity mirror. "In the days after the revolution," Bukharin was saying, "everyone was free to criticize Lenin in private. The only taboo involved raising the matter in public, of challenging the collective infallibility of the party, once a policy had been decided." "I have absolutely nothing against criticism made in private," Comrade Stalin said, "as long as it is made to my face and not behind my back." He lit a Kazbek Paparossi on the end of the wand between his lips. "Why is it every time I see you, we get into an argument?" "I wasn't aware that this was the case." The Kozain shrugged. "You surely didn't drop by to compare Lenin's style of leadership with mine. What brings you to my wing of the Kremlin on this rain-soaked day, Bukharchik?" Bukharin pulled a silk handkerchief from a jacket pocket and mopped his brow. "I want to talk to you about the arrest of the poet Mandelstam." "In the matter of Mandelstam, I, of course, had nothing to do with his arrest. Yagoda, who signed the warrant, informed me about it after the fact. He has apparently been charged with anti-Soviet propaganda and counter-revolutionary activities under Article 58 of the Penal Code." Bukharin leaned forward in the chair. "Mandelstam is a first-class poet, Koba, a credit to Soviet culture. But for some time now, he has not been quite normal. I understand he has confessed to the charges against him," the Kozain told his uninvited guest. "Pasternak got in touch with me about Mandelstam. He is extremely distressed about this. He and Mandelstam are personal friends." Dropping Pasternak's name into the conversation caught Stalin off guard. He scraped the chair back from the desk and, removing the cigarette from his mouth, brought it up to his eyes and studied the thin plume of smoke drifting toward the ceiling. "I was aware my boss had a certain esteem for Pasternak. It dated back to his wife's suicide and the perfunctory letters of condolence that flooded the press at the time. I happened to have brought around the newspapers the morning the news of Nadezhda's death, attributed, if memory serves, to peritonitis, was published. I found the Kozain in a foul mood, the rheumatic throbbing in his deformed arm having kept him up most of the night. Flipping open the newspapers, he read aloud the trite letters of condolence, his voice dripping with scorn. 'Accept our grief at the death of N.S. Alleluyeva,
a bright candle tragically extinguished, a comrade who will be sorely missed. That sort of thing. And then he stumbled across a short letter signed by Pasternak, who had apparently refused to add his name to the banal communication from the Union of Writers, preferring to publish a note of his own. The Kosyain snipped Pasternak's letter out of the newspaper and kept it on his blotter for months. As far as I know, it may still be there. I can confirm that Pasternak's letter, which read like a telegram and reeked of sincerity, was the single expression of condolence that brought any comfort to the shattered Stalin. As he took to reading it aloud in my presence every morning for weeks, I pretty much remember what Pasternak said. The day before her death was announced, I thought deeply and intensively about Stalin. As a poet, for the first time, next morning I read the news. I was shaken as though I had been there, living by his side, and had seen it. Boris Pasternak. The Kosyain resumed smoking, sucking on the cigarette in short, nervous puffs. What does Pasternak say exactly? He asked Bukharin. He was stunned to learn of Mandelstam's arrest. He asked me to tell you that in a quarrel between a poet and a political leader, the poet, whether he emerges alive or dead, always comes out on top. History, in Pasternak's scheme of things, is on the side of the poet. Fuck the cloud dweller, the Kosyain sneered, using the nickname he had bestowed on Pasternak. You can count on these rhymesters to stick together. It doesn't matter where the fault lies. All the same, I could tell from his tone that the boss was shaken. Bukharin realized that Pasternak's intervention had impressed Stalin. He drove the nail home. He says that Mandelstam isn't in his right mind. Years of humiliation, of not being published, of begging or borrowing money to make ends meet, have pushed him into madness. He's not rational, not responsible for his actions. The Kosyain interrupted Bukharin. Would you be interested in reading the particular poem, written out in his own hand, that caused him to be charged with anti-Soviet propaganda? Bukharin could only nod. Comrade Stalin pulled a folded paper from the inside pocket of his tunic and slid it across the desk. Bukharin reached to retrieve it and, unfolding the paper, started reading as the Kosyain, smiling in grim satisfaction, spit out phrases from memory. Kremlin mountaineer, murderer and peasant slayer, fingers fat as grubs, words final as lead weights, cockroach whiskers. I had heard from Yagoda that Mandelstam had been arrested for an outrageous poem. But up to that moment, I had no idea what was in it. The contents must have come as a bombshell to Bukharin, too. The color literally drained from his features, leaving him as pale as a peeled pear. When he looked up, he seemed to be in a state of shock. I had no idea. Nobody told me. I assumed he would be beating about the bush. They suggested it was no more outrageous than what Mandelstam usually wrote. Bukharin collected himself. Still, Koba, this poem only proves Pasternak's point. No sane person could have written these lines. They stand as proof of his madness. Why?
Why?
Yes, why are these lines proof of madness? From my place at the back of the room, I could almost see the wheels turning in Bukharin's head. He understood it wasn't only Mandelstam's life that was in jeopardy, but Bukharin's. The lines are proof of madness because they are inaccurate, Koba. He doesn't make a rational argument that one can take issue with. He has resorted to slander of the worst kind. This is evidence of irrationality, and the irrationality must be seen as a symptom of madness.
You made a big mistake interfering in this affair, the Kosyain said coldly. I won't forget it.
Bukharin, it must be conceded, had balls.
There were times when you thanked me for interfering, he snapped. I still have the revolver you gave me with the inscription to the leader of the proletarian revolution in Bukharin from J. Stalin.
My boss replied angrily, if you want to talk about your past merits, no one can take them away from you. But Trotsky had them too. Speaking between ourselves, few had as many merits before the revolution as Trotsky.
The Kosyain aimed his index finger at Bukharin. I will take it amiss if you repeat what I said.
He waved the back of his good hand to indicate the interview was over. I reached for the knob and pulled open the door. Bukharin rose to his feet.
You're not the revolutionist I knew when we joined Lenin in the struggle to change the world, Koba, he said. You used to be grateful for the support of your Bolshevik comrades.
Gratitude is a dog's disease, Stalin shot back.
Bukharin regarded Stalin for a moment as if he intended to have the last word. Then, shaking his head in disgust, he hurried past me. When Bukharin was gone, the cousin gestured for the door to be shut. It's not every day you see someone sign his own death warrant, he noted. About Mandelstam, the shitty thing is that Pasternak is probably right. History is a bitch, and the bitch is on the side of the fucking poets. He looked up. Get hold of your Goda, Vlasic. Tell him not to put Mandelstam on the overnight list again. We'll pin a -12 on him. Keep him away from the 12 major cities for a few years. That'll give him time to work through his madness. When he comes to his senses, we'll kill him for his sanity. At which point the Kozein, I'll say what happened and leave you to figure out what it means. The Kozein dragged the cigarette from his lips and ground it out on the back of his hand. It's something the boss must have picked up during his years in Siberia. Real criminals doing time for murder did this to show the political prisoners how tough they were. Looking at the burn mark, my boss nodded, as if the gesture brought back memories. Then he uttered something that confused me when he said it, and makes even less sense to me now. What he said was, "Nobody's innocent, Vlasic. Not Mandelstam, not Pasternak, not that harlot Akhmatova, not Bukharin. Not even you. Nobody."
Chapter 13. Boris Pasternak, Thursday, the 23rd of May, 1934. Few things disheartened me more than a row with Akhmatova, probably because she turned out to be right more often than not, which is something I would grasp only after she'd hung down the phone. To add to my general sense of aggravation, I shared my father's old apartment with six other families, whose children produced such a racket in the communal hallway you could barely make out what your interlocutor was saying. So picture it. There I was, standing in the telephone niche in the corridor, barefooted, after having rushed from the communal toilet to answer a call, my suspenders plunging to my shins, the telephone pressed to my ear, children scampering back and forth kicking a ball made of old rags tied with string, and me shouting into the mouthpiece, begging Anna to repeat what she had just said. But of course she had raced on to make another point that may or may not have had anything to do with her previous point. Mandelstam's arrest had put us all on edge, and Anna was reproaching herself, and me, and every last member of the Union of Writers, for not fulfilling our duty as poets, in sharp contrast to Osip Emilievich, who was rotting in prison for withstanding pressure that the rest of us bowed to. "Define what you mean by the duty of a poet," I hollered. "Truth-telling," she shouted back. "You can't do an awful lot of truth-telling from the grave," I retorted, but you probably never heard me. Akhmatova was engaged in truth-telling, of course. What I had valued above all in the revolution, back when I'd valued the revolution, was its moral side. I'd actually entertained the idea that life would take a turn for the better, that art would be free to cut to the bone, that artists could agree to disagree and still honour one another. I remember Mayakovsky once flinging a long arm over my shoulder after a bitter argument and saying, "We really are different, Boris. You love lightning in the sky. I love it in an electric iron." Nowadays it was no longer possible to harbour the delusion that tomorrow would be better than today, or that today was an improvement over yesterday. And this insight changed my life as an artist, for as far back as I can remember, I had devoted myself to poetry, which is to say to the art closest to sign language, code writing, and other signalling systems. Now I was drifting toward the view that life had grown too complicated for lyric poetry to express the immensity of our experience, that what we had lived through was best captured in prose. I dreamt of writing a novel that would seal my oeuvre, like a lid on a box. I dreamt of writing a novel that would conquer my incoherence as a poet, and show how the Russian Revolution had swept away everything established, everything settled, everything to do with home and order. But I'm wandering from the subject. Akhmatova, beside herself with anxiety over the fate of our dear friend Mandelstam, Pasternak, trying to defend himself against attacks that were never launched,
both of us overwhelmed with guilt because Osip was inside the Lubyanka and we were outside. Some hours passed. I lay stretched out on the daybed in the half of my father's old painting studio that had been partitioned off and allotted to me, lighting up my fifth cigarette of the day, still hoping to limit myself to 6 before midnight, when one of my neighbors called out that I had another phone call. I assumed it was Akhmatova, ringing back to apologize for things that neither of us could remember her saying. The children, thanks to God, were playing up at the other end of the corridor when I picked up the telephone. Pasternak? Speaking. Alexander Proskrebyshev on the line. Do you have paper and pencil? 1 second. I tugged open the drawer and found the message pad and a pencil. For some reason I pulled up my suspenders, snapping them onto my shoulders. Ready, I said into the telephone. I'm going to give you a private Kremlin telephone number. Dial it in 3 minutes. He read out the number and had me read it back to be sure I'd noted it correctly. Without another word, he hung up. My heart was racing. Why would Stalin's chef de cabinet be calling me? And who would I find at the other end of the line when I dialed the Kremlin number? I hauled my pocket watch from my trousers and stared at the second hand, convinced that it had slowed to a snail's crawl, that at its present speed, a day would last 48 hours, which would make limiting oneself to 6 cigarettes more difficult. When I thought 3 minutes had gone by, I dialed the number. I was so tense I got it wrong the first time and had to dial again. Someone answered immediately. Do you recognize my voice, Pasternak? No. The man on the other end of the line laughed quietly. Stalin here. I want to talk to you about Mandelstam. I want you to know that I didn't authorize his arrest. The children were kicking the ball back down the corridor and yelling as they ran after it. I can't hear very well. There are kids playing in the corridor. Can you say that again? Stalin raised his voice. I didn't authorize Mandelstam's arrest. When I learned about it, I found it disgraceful. I am calling to let you know that Mandelstam's case is being reviewed at the highest level. I have a feeling everything will turn out all right for him. The fact of your taking a personal interest in the matter will reassure a great many artists and writers, I shouted. The children had passed. I clearly heard Stalin say, But he is a genius, isn't he? That's not the point, I said. What is the point? He demanded. My brain flooded with possibilities. Perhaps Osip was wrong after all. Perhaps I was right. Perhaps Stalin was living in a bubble, unaware of what the Czechists were doing in the real world outside the Kremlin. If only someone could let him know about the famine, the arrests, the executions, the deportations. Joseph Vissarionovich, I absolutely must talk to you.
You are talking to me.
I mean face to face. I mean man to man. He hesitated. About what do you want to talk? I stupidly said the first thing that came into my head. About life. About death. I pressed the receiver to my ear as hard as I could so as not to miss his reply. I thought I could hear Stalin breathing, and then the line went dead. I kept listening to be sure there was no mistake, all the time bitterly berating myself for not having found the right words, for having passed up the opportunity of a lifetime with my clumsiness. I cut the connection with a finger, then lifted the phone to my ear and waited for a dial tone. When I heard one, I dialed the Kremlin number again. It rang 16 times before someone answered. Joseph Vissarionovich, I shouted, I beg you to give me a moment to explain.
This is Proskrebyshev.
Can you put me through to Stalin, please?
Impossible. He is no longer in Moscow. Don't dial this number again. It was activated for one call and will no longer exist after I hang up. Do you understand, Pasternak?
I do not understand. I heard the line go dead again. Chapter 14. Fikrit Shotman, Saturday the 25th of May, 1934.
Ever since Vienna, Austria, where, as I may have mentioned, I won the silver weightlifting medal, I've been accustomed to flashbulbs exploding in my face. To tell the truth, I don't really mind them. It makes me feel important. So while my co-defendants at the trial covered their eyes with their arms as we entered the October Hall, upstairs in the House of Unions, I smiled and waved to let everyone know that although I was pleading guilty, I was innocent in the sense I didn't know what I was guilty of until Christofferovitch educated me. With its high windows and gold-coloured curtains and crystal chandeliers, this was as fancy a room as I ever set foot in, but I decided not to let on that I felt out of my depth. When I spotted the three judges, decked out in black robes and sitting in high-backed thrones on the raised platform, I raised high my right hand and saluted them in the style of Azerbaijan peasants. Judging from their grins, they weren't indifferent to my mountain ways. The courtroom was overflowing with spectators. There was more than turned up on any given day to watch the strongman perform at the circus. I tried to count them, but I gave up when I reached 100. There were easily three times that, which is as high as I count without help from Agrippina, who, I was thrilled to see, was sitting in the very first row, protected by men in black suits on either side of her. I waved to her, and she smiled back one of the forced smiles she produced when she was really sad. She had this crazy idea that smiling could suck the sadness out of your heart, the way the juice of an onion could suck a wart out of the flat of your foot. I recognized 8 or 10 faces in the courtroom. The woman who had copied down my confession was there, along with several lady clerks I'd run into when they took me to the Lubyanka clothing store to fit me out with a suit for the trial. Christofferovitch was there, smiling and nodding encouragement. I even spotted the wrestler Islam Issa against a wall near the recessed gallery, with tinted windows in the back, where the orchestra used to play for the aristocrats before our revolution fired the aristocrats. Christofferovitch confided to me that Comrade Stalin himself sometimes watched trials from behind the tinted windows. Comrade Interrogator knew this, because the cleaning lady reported emptying ashtrays filled with his favourite cigarette, Kazbek Paparossi, sitting at the end of Agrippina's row were the foreign journalists. You could tell they were foreign by the lapels on their suits and by the fact that they sat with their legs crossed, which is something no self-respecting Soviet journalist would do in the formal situation of a trial. Procurator General A. Vyshinsky, who, as every schoolchild knew, once shared the hampers of food supplied by his rich parents with Comrade Stalin when the two were in jail together, stood leaning on the half-circle bar across from me, studying sheets of paper in a file folder. As for my co-defendants, we were never actually introduced. We were thrown together in the basement holding cell an hour or so before the trial got underway. I never knew their names until Procurator General Vyshinsky called them out at the trial. Knud Trifonovich Ignatieff? The little man on my right, wearing a baggy suit with a soiled shirt buttoned up to his neck, with a moustache trimmed exactly like Comrade Vyshinsky's, stood up. "That's me, Your Honour," he said. Comrade Vyshinsky read out the charges against the accused Ignatieff. Wrecking, treason, counter-revolutionary activities in violation of Penal Code Article 58. "How is it you plead?" "Guilty." "Kindly tell the court," Comrade Vyshinsky said, peering at the accused through his horn-rimmed spectacles, his voice oozing contempt, "how a Russian national like yourself winds up with a name like Knut." "My mother was Danish, my father Russian. I was called Knut after my maternal grandfather." Comrade Vyshinsky turned to address their honours, the judges. "As you will see, the accused Ignatieff's connection with Denmark is pertinent to the accusations against him." He turned back to the accused, who was clutching the bar to steady himself. "In your capacity as librarian-in-chief for the Greater Moscow District, how many libraries did you direct?" "In addition to the Great Lenin Library and the 4 university libraries, I was in overall charge of 47 neighborhood libraries." "In your role as director of all these libraries, am I correct in stating that you were responsible for the destruction of books that were considered to be subversive?"
"That is correct, Comrade Procurator General."
"And how were you alerted to the fact that the responsible authorities considered certain books to be subversive and thus must be destroyed?"
"At weekly intervals, I received a typewritten list from the Office of the Commissar for Cultural Affairs. On 2 occasions, I received a note from Comrade Stalin himself, inquiring why such and such a book was still available to the general public."
"Then what happened?"
"Along with a female assistant, I made the rounds of the libraries in the small van allocated to my department and collected the offending volumes. I drove to one of the waste disposal plants on the outskirts of Moscow
and personally supervised the destruction of the offending volumes. They were burned in the incinerators, is that correct?
That is correct, Comrade Procurator General.
On the 12th of March of this year, you were apprehended while supervising the destruction of volumes at the...
The Procurator General bent his head to read from the charge sheet in the folder.
At the Yaroslav District Waste Station on the Yaroslav Highway. Will you tell the court why?
Included in the cartons of books earmarked for destruction were 17 copies of Lenin's collected works and 8 copies of Stalin's collected works. Comrade Vyshinsky came around the Procurator General's bar and approached the box of the accused.
Would you be so kind as to tell the court, Knud Trifonovich Ignatieff, how you came to be destroying the widely admired texts of Comrade Lenin and Comrade Stalin?
I am a charter member of the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center. I was following specific orders issued to me by Trotsky's son, Sedov, during a meeting in Copenhagen, Denmark, where I had gone, with party permission, to attend the funeral of my mother's father, the Knut, after whom I am named.
Comrade Vyshinsky glanced again at the charge sheet.
This meeting took place on the 14th of February 1934 at 3:30 in the afternoon at the Hotel Bristol. Is that correct?
No. People in the courtroom gasped. Comrade Vyshinsky's mouth fell open. The three judges on the raised platform conferred in undertones. Comrade Procurator General checked the charge sheet.
You have admitted under interrogation that you met Trotsky's son, Sedov, in the Bristol Hotel. Are you retracting your confession? Accused Ignatieff.
Your Honours, I described my meeting with Sedov in a Copenhagen hotel. I never mentioned the Bristol. That must have been added by the stenographer or the interrogator. I couldn't have met Sedov in the Bristol on the 14th of February 1934 because the hotel, which I knew well, was demolished in 1917.
Comrade Vyshinsky turned toward their Honours on the raised platform.
Needless to say, it doesn't matter in which hotel the meeting was held. The important point, which has been established beyond a shadow of a doubt, is that the accused Ignatieff received his wrecking orders directly from Trotsky's son, Sedov, in a Copenhagen hotel.
He turned back toward the accused.
Why did Sedov want you to destroy the texts signed by Lenin and Stalin?
I asked him that very question, Ignatieff testified in a dull voice.
He said that cleansing the libraries of Lenin and Stalin was the first phase of the intricately planned counter-revolution that would be launched by Trotsky. I happened to have been apprehended before the library wrecking program could swing into full gear. Stalin, along with you, Comrade Procurator General, and other members of the Soviet leadership, were to be eliminated, after which we Trotskyists would restore capitalism in Russia.
There were angry cries from the crowd of shame, and death is too good for the traitor.
Comrade Vyshinsky's tone turned mild. Do you, accused Ignatieff, affirm that your confession is voluntary, that you were not coerced in any manner or form by the interrogators assigned to your case?
I do.
Do you affirm the accuracy of your voluntary confession?
With the exception of the Hotel Bristol, I do.
One more thing, Comrade Vyshinsky said. Be so kind as to tell the court how the members of the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center were supposed to recognize each other.
The recognition sign was the Eiffel Tower. It might be an Eiffel Tower sticker on a valise or a briefcase. It might be an Eiffel Tower pin in the buttonhole of a lapel. It might be an actual miniature of the Eiffel Tower set casually on a table or sideboard in someone's office or apartment.
Comrade Vyshinsky returned to his bar and removed another charge sheet from the folder.
Galina Yegorova,
he called. The woman sitting between Ignatieff and me got slowly to her feet. I guessed she must have been wearing the dress she had on at the time of her arrest. I say this because, like Ignatieff's suit, it was very rumpled. The hem of the long skirt soiled as if it had been sweeping the ground for weeks. In addition, the dress had a very un-Soviet low-cut bodice that was an insult to Bolshevik modesty. If Agrippina had turned up in an outfit like that, much as I love her, she would have felt the back of my hand.
The accused Yegorova, wife of the Red Army commander until recently in charge of a military district in Central Asia, is charged with anti-Soviet slander, treason, and counter-revolutionary activities in violation of Penal Code Article 58.
How is it you plead?
When I heard the Procurator General say her name, it hit me that this was the lady who was the talk of the Lubyanka. Prison scuttlebutt talked about a female inmate who was not only a well-known motion picture actress, but a personal friend of Comrade Stalin. I couldn't help but wonder if he was sitting behind the tinted windows at the back of the courtroom watching her. I couldn't help but think that if he was watching her, he would recognize me from the time he shook my hand in the Kremlin. Something Agrippina once said when the director of our circus was arrested for skimming off ticket receipts came to mind. How the mighty have fallen. Clearly the same was true for the poor lady leaning her weight on the bar next to me to keep from sinking to her knees. She looked to be about 40, going on 60 if you catch my meaning. The skin on her face was white, like a clown's. Her eyes were scared. Her breasts were sagging so badly in her bodice, you wanted to turn your head away from embarrassment. She squinted as if she was having trouble focusing on the Procurator General and their honours, the judges. I heard her say in a hoarse voice, "Guilty." One of the judges called out, "You will have to speak up."
"I plead guilty to the charges against me,"
the lady said in a louder voice. Again Comrade Vyshinsky came out from behind the Procurator's bar and approached the accused.
"Galina Yegorova, on or about 16th March of this year, at a cocktail party celebrating the completion of your latest motion picture, you were heard to say,"
he bent his head to the paper in his hands,
"with all these terrorists loose in Moscow trying to kill Stalin, it is amazing he is still alive. Were those your words?"
"They were taken out of context," she muttered.
"This is your last warning," the judge said. "Speak up or we will hold you in contempt of this court."
"The words were taken out of context, Your Honor. It was not my intention to cast doubt on the stories in Pravda concerning the terrorists known to be operating in Moscow, or the trials of terrorists who have admitted trying to assassinate members of the leadership. I was only suggesting that with all these terrorists active in the city, it was amazing, as in a miracle, that thanks to the watchfulness of our Chekists, they had not succeeded in assassinating our beloved Joseph Vissarionovich."
On the raised platform, the three judges put their heads together. The lead judge addressed the witness.
"Accused Yegorova, it cannot help your case that you refer to our esteemed leader by his name and patronymic. Outside his intimate circle of colleagues and friends, he is known as Comrade Stalin."
Yegorova lowered her eyes.
"I will not make the same mistake a second time, Your Honor."
Comrade Vyshinsky said,
"If it pleases the court, I will offer in evidence the signed confession of Yegorova's husband, who was arrested on the charge of high treason in January and has been cooperating with the interrogator since then."
Comrade Vyshinsky placed a folder on the table in front of the judges.
"So noted,"
the lead judge remarked, and he began to leaf through the folder, passing pages to the other judges as he finished skimming them.
"Red Army Commander Yegorov has confessed to being an agent of the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center,"
Comrade Vyshinsky continued.
"He has admitted organizing a counter-revolutionary uprising in the Central Asian military district, of which he was the commander. He has also implicated his wife, the accused Galina Yegorova, in the plot to overthrow the existing order and restore capitalism under the leadership of the arch-traitor Leon Trotsky."
Comrade Procurator General absently polished the lenses of his eyeglasses with the tip of his tie.
"Be so kind as to tell the court what your precise role was in this counter-revolutionary conspiracy."
"Why don't you just read it out from my husband's confession? Better still, why don't you put my husband on the witness stand and let him describe my role himself?"
There was a low growl from the audience in response to this arrogant outburst from the witness. Comrade Vyshinsky scowled.
"Commander Yegorov was so humiliated when his role in the conspiracy came to light that he attempted to kill himself by hitting his head against the stone wall of his cell. He is currently being treated for a severe concussion in the Lubyanka clinic. My husband's confession was extracted under torture."
Now there was a roar of real outrage from the audience. "Slander!" a woman shrieked.
"Defamation of our Chekists, who are guardians of the revolution!"
another woman shouted. The lead judge slammed his gavel down on the table.
"Silence!"
he roared. He addressed the accused Yegorova.
"Is it your claim that your husband's confession, which we have before our eyes, dated
bearing the interrogator's official seal, signed by him and by two witnesses, signed also by the stenographer, was extracted under duress.
I am absolutely certain that Commander Yegorov is a loyal Stalinist and was never involved in any counter-revolutionary schemes,
Yegorova declared. Comrade Vyshinsky ran a finger between his starched collar and his neck.
You have admitted under interrogation that you served as a messenger for the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center. You have admitted that you were contacted by Trotsky's son, Sedov, in a Berlin hotel when you attended the Berlin Film Festival in October of last year. Is the court to understand that you are withdrawing your confession?
I maintain my confession. I met Sedov in the Berlin hotel, the name of which slips my mind. He gave me a pack of German filter-tip cigarettes, the brand name of which slips my mind. Several of the cigarettes, so I was told, contained instructions for counter-revolutionary wrecking activities printed on the inside of the cigarette paper. Acting on Sedov's instructions, I crossed the frontier back into the Soviet Union, carrying the pack of cigarettes in full view in my leather purse. As I left the hotel room after my meeting with Sedov, he moistened the back of an Eiffel Tower sticker with his tongue and pasted it onto my purse as a recognition sign. He instructed me to deliver the cigarettes to the person in the central librarian's office who had a similar sticker visible on his briefcase. This person, who was to pass on the wrecking instructions to other members of the backup Paris-based Trotskyist anti-Bolshevik center, turned out to be the accused, Ignatieff. At no time did I deliver the cigarettes and the instructions they contained to my husband or any of his officers or friends in the Central Asian Military District. This I most emphatically deny. Comrade Vyshinsky tossed his head.
What you are telling the court, accused Yegorova, contradicts your signed confession. You don't deny that that is your signature on the notarized confession, which I have already placed in evidence before this court.
I was promised my life would be spared if I implicated my husband. In a moment of weakness, I signed the confession that was put in front of me. The truth is that my husband is completely innocent, as God is my witness. He was unaware of my counter-revolutionary activities. Isn't it enough that I admit my guilt? Why do you need to destroy the both of us? The lead judge said, "Your life depends on your telling the truth in this matter of the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center." The accused Yegorova's strength gave out before my eyes, and she sank to her knees, her chin resting on the low bar. The soldier posted behind her gripped her under the armpits and started to haul her to her feet. In the process, a strap of her dress slipped off one shoulder, exposing a breast for everyone to see. I reached over before the soldier behind me could interfere. He was half my size and would have been hard put to restrain me if I wasn't willing to be restrained, and pulled the strap back up on her shoulder. Comrade Vyshinsky, an experienced procurator, was unfazed by the turn of events.
Let the court note that in the face of two signed confessions, her own and that of her husband, the accused Yegorova has perjured herself to protect her husband, has in fact put loyalty to her traitor husband ahead of loyalty to the Soviet state and the revolution. The evidence, Your Honours, is overwhelming. The counter-revolutionary activities of the accused Ignatieff and the accused Red Army commander Yegorov, who will be tried in a separate proceeding when he has recovered from his self-inflicted head wounds, bear out the conspiracy initiated by Trotsky's son Sedov and transmitted to the Moscow section of the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center by the accused Yegorova.
Comrade Vyshinsky made his way back to the Procurator General's bar and opened a new folder. And I knew my turn had come at long last. To my delight, he called out my name.
Fikrit Trofimovich Shotman.
I saw Agrippina cover her eyes with her hands. I saw the men sitting on either side of her grip her wrists and pull her hands away from her face. I gave her an encouraging smile.
Present, I cried in a loud and firm voice, and eager to admit my guilt as I have come to understand it. And before Comrade Procurator General could get his tongue around a question, I commenced my confession. I described in great detail how I had been recruited in Vienna, Austria in 1932 when I was representing the Soviet Union in the weightlifting competition at the All-European Games. How I'd been given a cash payment in United States dollars to finance my wrecking activities. How I'd communicated with my handler, an American secret agent masquerading as a weightlifter,
using a secret code buried in the dedication inside the cover of an American fitness magazine. How, carried away by my hatred for the new order, I had even disfigured Stalin's face tattooed on my upper arm. To dramatize the point, I flung off the jacket of my new suit, unbuttoned my shirt, and bared my arm, angling my left bicep toward the crowd so they could all see the rope burn across the faded tattoo. In the front row, Agrippina turned her head away and I could make out enormous tears flowing down her beautiful cheeks, but I knew I was doing the right thing. I had Comrade Interrogator Kristoforovich's word for it. Comrade Vyshinsky tried to interrupt as I was buttoning my shirt, but I interrupted his interruption. "There's more," I declared, climbing back into my jacket, and I told about the worthless Tsarist loan coupons I kept in my trunk against the day when Trotsky's counter-revolution, in which I was a foot soldier, drove the Bolsheviks from power and restored capitalism in Soviet Russia, at which point my Tsarist coupons could be redeemed at their face value. Comrade Procurator General took advantage of me having to come up for air to inquire about the significance of the Eiffel Tower sticker on my steamer trunk. "I'm glad you asked. I almost forgot about the Eiffel Tower. Let me say, for those of you not familiar with it, that the Eiffel Tower, located in Paris, France, doesn't hold a candle to the towers you can find in our own Soviet Union. True, they may not be as big as the one in Paris, France, but every woman knows it's not size that counts." Some of the ladies in the courtroom started giggling, but shut up when one of the judges tapped his wooden gavel on the table. The judge nodded at me to continue, and I did. "When I was recruited into the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center during the All-European Games in Vienna, Austria, I was given the Eiffel Tower sticker and ordered to paste it on my steamer trunk as a recognition signal so that other conspirators in the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center could identify me as a member of this gang." The lead judge spoke up from his high back throne on the raised platform. "Let me say it is to the credit of the accused Shotman that he has chosen to make a clean breast of his crimes. Anyone with a grain of sense can see that he is not attempting to hide or mitigate his guilt, and this will certainly be taken into consideration when it comes time to pass sentence." I didn't understand what the judge meant by mitigate, but I nodded my thanks to him from my place in the box of the accused. The lady judge, sitting to the right of the lead judge, raised a finger.
"I would like to ask the accused Shotman precisely what his role was in the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center."
"My role?"
"What were you supposed to do to further the counter-revolution?"
the lady judge explained. I looked over at Kristoforovich for a sign of what I might answer. He had never raised this matter with me when I rehearsed my confession, but there was no help to be had from him. I glanced at Agrippina, but she avoided my eye. I turned to the lady judge.
"Why, my role was to wreck. I signed on as a wrecker."
"Wreck what?"
the lady judge persisted. I shrugged. "Until my knee went bad, I was a champion weightlifter. Until my arrest, I was a circus strongman. Look at me, your honors. Look at my hands. Look at my shoulders. I can wreck whatever I am told needs wrecking."
Comrade Vyshinsky came to my rescue.
"It is clear from his confession that the accused Shotman was ready to follow wrecking instructions sent to him by the backup Trotskyist Paris-based anti-Bolshevik center. There may have been specific wrecking instructions from Sedov printed inside one of the cigarettes that the accused Yegorova delivered to the accused Ignatiev, but were never forwarded due to the timely arrest of these two conspirators. The important element to bear in mind is that the accused Shotman was a member of the conspiracy and ready to carry out Sedov's wrecking orders when they reached him."
The lead judge looked over at me.
"Does the accused Shotman wish to add anything to his testimony?" It was here that I came up with the words Kristoforovich had drummed into my head.
"No matter what my punishment will be, your honors, I, in advance, consider it just."
I looked intently at the tinted windows at the back of the courtroom. "Let us all go forward behind Comrade Stalin." Several in the courtroom, Kristoforovich, Islam Issa, the lady who had taken down my confession, some of the lady clerks, began clapping their hands.
Others joined them until the entire room was filled with applause. Flashbulbs went off in my face. I felt Agrippina's eyes on me and comprehended that, for once, she would not be ashamed of her fikrit. I turned to the audience and, my knuckles scraping the floor of the prisoner's box, bowed from the waist. The rest of the trial passed in a haze of speeches from defense lawyers. Until that moment, I didn't know we had been assigned defense lawyers, demanding the ultimate penalty for my two co-defendants. These mad dogs of capitalism try to tear, limb from limb, the best of our Soviet land. I insist that we do with them what we do with mad dogs, which is to say, we shoot them. The lady lawyer assigned to defend me rose and said, Fikrit Shotman has demonstrated genuine remorse and cooperated fully with the authorities. For him I ask the judges to impose a lenient sentence of 4 years' hard labor in the Far East. There were cries from the crowd of, the mad dogs must be shot, and leniency for Shotman, as the three judges left the courtroom to deliberate. They filed back 20 minutes later. The lead judge read out the verdicts. The accused, Ignatiev and Yegorova, was condemned to be shot, sentenced to be carried out immediately. Me? I pulled 4 years. In the courtroom, Agrippina collapsed into the arms of one of the men in dark suits. To my right, the accused Ignatiev blew a kiss to an old lady on crutches at the back of the courtroom before he turned to leave the box. The accused Yegorova sank to the floor in a dead faint. The two soldiers had trouble raising her. I shouldered them aside and lifted her as if she was a child's doll, and carried her in my arms back to the holding cell in the basement and, carefully straightening her dress, set her gently out on a bench. The last I saw of her, looking over my shoulder as I headed back to my cell block, the guards were trying to revive her with smelling salts, so they could take her to execution.